Okay.
It's on.
Alright. And another thing we were interested in is, interview with Dr. Stuhlinger. were there, or how much criticism was of there of the Saturn program in specific, not Apollo necessarily, the Saturn program? And was the high water thing done kind of an answer to scientific critics? Or was it you simply had space available? Or really, where did the high water program originate?
The origin of high water, I believe, was manifold. There was criticism from some people who said we should not launch more Florida sand into orbit as we did before, just to ballast our vehicles. And so we decided to launch something better than sand, but it would have to be something that was cheap and heavy at the same time, because we needed a certain ballast for to try out the certain ones. And it occurred to some members of this center here, of the Marshall Center, who worked in the Space Sciences Laboratory at the time, that one possible answer to the request for a heavy, useful, but still inexpensive payload might be the launching of a large amount of water, which would be released quickly at high altitudes, and one would then study from the ground how this water behaves if it is all of a sudden exposed to vacuum under weightlessness and under space conditions. The design and engineering aspect of this experiment was relatively simple, because there was nothing active in this project except the command to rip the container open at the right point. The container was filled with water then, and the opening of the container was done by primer cord, which was ignited by a command. I do not remember at this moment whether it was a command from the ground or from a timer. I believe it was a timer. Timer on board the spacecraft. This can be read in the original reports. And then there were a number of observing instruments on the ground, among them film cameras and radiation sensors. What we were after particularly was the question how quickly the water would vaporize, how quickly it would expand, to what size it would expand, how long the cloud or whatever would happen would stay there, how long it would take before that cloud disappeared and was changed into an invisible system. We did make a number of experiments on the ground before the launch of high water, in which we exposed small quantities of water to vacuum in laboratory experiments. And we had some anticipation of what might happen in the flight experiment. Now, I don't think that anybody thought that this experiment would be an extremely earth-shaking and revealing experiment as far as the basic laws of physics or the our knowledge of nature were concerned. On the other hand, we expected that we would have some interesting results, which would tell us a little bit more about the behavior of large amounts of matter if they are all of a sudden exposed to high vacuum. The experiment itself worked very well. It functioned as anticipated. Among the sensors, not all of them worked fully. If I remember correctly, then some of the specific radiation sensors for infrared and some, I believe it was for infrared, did not work properly. And one reason was because the whole experiment was to be a low-cost experiment, and we could not spend a large amount of money to develop very elaborate experiments for ground observations. On the other hand, we obtained very good movie pictures of the event, and we could determine the speed of expansion of the cloud and the distance to which it expanded, and we could find out the lifetime of the cloud in orbit. Now, if you like to have more precise data of this kind, you should look them up in the reports which were written. I don't remember them offhand.
Okay, I mean, I haven't gotten that far yet. I have done some research on Pegasus, but I just haven't done the high water material.
Yeah. Now, again, high water should not be classified as an extremely important scientific experiment, which clarified very severe problems which mankind was facing before the experiment was done. On the other hand, we are glad that we did make it. It was a good use of existing opportunities and of the capability of the vehicle to lift large amounts of water into orbit. That's about how we look at it now from looking back from today.
So it's just primarily a payload kind of experiment in terms of ballast, really.
This is one aspect of it. We had to ballast the vehicle anyway, just to make it a realistic flight test for the vehicle. And rather than putting in something completely inert like sand from the Florida beaches, we decided that we would like to make this experiment. And within that framework, we are certainly correct to say that it was successful, it was a good experiment. On the other hand, one would not have launched a Saturn particularly for that purpose, only in order to study what a volume of water is doing if exposed to vacuum. One would not have justified a launching just for that purpose.
Were there any considerations that this might be an interesting experiment in terms of what might happen if the second stage, say, ruptured before ignition? You have all of this, say, liquid hydrogen and oxygen. Does it give you any parameters as to what might happen in that instance?
It sure would, because but one of the things we studied was the influence of a cloud like this on communications. There was a possibility that it may interrupt communications for some time, because several effects can be thought of which could be leading to this. For example, this cloud could stay there for a long time and could shield off some of the ultraviolet radiation which produces the ionosphere. So this cloud could in essence produce a hole in the ionosphere, and the ionosphere, as you know, is needed for the reflection of radio signals if you want to propagate a message at this time and in this general area. So this was one of the effects we were after. We wanted to see how this cloud would affect communications.
And it didn't have any particular negative effects that you could ascertain?
I do not remember that we found any real adverse effects, but again, you should look that up in the reports.
Was it, okay, and you found that the cloud really didn't expand as far as you thought?
The cloud did expand quicker and farther than we thought.
Oh, okay.
In fact, it had a diameter of about 10 kilometers, which is pretty big volume. You know, it's a sphere of 10 kilometers diameter. We could see it very well. It was a beautiful view. The vehicle went up, and then, of course, one didn't see anything because it was too far away, and the ignition was cut off. And then, when it had reached its apex, the rupture of the water container occurred, and what you saw was first just blue sky and nothing, and all of a sudden, within a tenth of a second, there was a huge cloud, bigger than the moon, wide and a little tenuous, more tenuous than the moon, but bigger than the moon, and it was all of a sudden there in the sky, and then it faded away in the course of about 10 minutes, it disappeared. And the disappearance is, we believe, because the little ice crystals, which were first formed by the rapid expansion, they were warmed up and vaporized, melted and vaporized because of solar irradiation, solar heating.
So you could call it or maybe this is incorrect, was the high water the first big experiment in a Saturn mission, purely scientific?
It was certainly the first large one.
Yeah.
The first large one, that is certainly correct.
Okay, is it okay to get on to Pegasus now?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And I guess the real question I'd like to know more than anything, were there any statistics derived from the detection satellites that really influenced the design either of Saturn launch vehicle or the Apollo spacecraft?
From Pegasus.
From Pegasus.
By all means, yes. The situation before, by the way, that is Pegasus here.
Yes, uh-huh.
The situation before Pegasus was about the following. When you plot here the number of meteorites mm-hmm. occurring or being there in the vicinity of the Earth as a function of their mass, then we had a few measurements up here, that means at small masses, mm-hmm. and we had a few down there, very erratic and few, of visible meteorites, those which make a streak of light as meteors and which can be seen. But these were diffuse, and these were diffuse in the diagram, so we did not know how many meteorites there would be of this size, and this size about is important for spacecraft. Below that size they are too small, they don't do any damage, and above this size they are too rare mm-hmm. to be afraid of them. But in here are those meteorites which are big enough to puncture a wall of a space vehicle and still frequent enough to be of concern. And we did not know whether this curve in here was going like this or like this or like this. This is logarithmic, by the way. Mm-hmm. You understand what a logarithmic...
Just basically, diagram. We went... okay. A little bit. Go ahead with your diagram.
Well,
okay.
Anyway, the diagram could have been... could have had any shape of number of shapes, and since that is a logarithmic diagram here, the difference between here and here would mean a factor of 10,000 about in frequency. Mm-hmm. So we didn't know whether a mass of this kind here would occur, say, 3 times a day or 30,000 times a day. And this is, of course, extremely important to know, because the design and the protection of spacecraft will depend on that. And so around 1961 or 62, when we began to design Saturn and to develop plans for Saturn and for the Apollo, we were very uncertain of how the meteor danger would be in space. Mm-hmm. And then at that time it occurred, in my laboratory at that time, in Space Sciences Laboratory, SSL, one of the subjects of research and of studies which we had was to find out how many meteorites there are in space, how big they are, and in fact how this function would look like. We looked at that time through all the papers which were available and measurements and observations, and we found that there were just not enough available in this dangerous or important region to tell us how many there were and how thick we would have to design and build our spacecraft walls. And then we decided in SSL at that time that the only way to find out more about it would be to build a satellite and to measure it and observe it. Mm-hmm. And then we sat together and tried to find out how big that thing would have to be and how sensitive and so forth and how long it should be in orbit so that we could obtain significant numbers. Mm-hmm. The problem here, the problem is the following. There are not many meteorites, but if a spacecraft in space is hit only once or twice in the course of a year, that's too much. Mm-hmm. Now to measure this number, to measure a number of one or two per year, hitting a spacecraft of, say, the size of this room here, means, of course, that we should measure either with a larger craft or for a longer time in order to pin down that number, because it's a statistical number which varies quite a bit. And if we have only a small satellite, it maybe hits just once per year, and we still don't know, was that a chance event which occurs once every 100 years, or was it just a particularly good year where we had only one hit, while the next year would have encountered 10 hits, we wouldn't know. So the requirement was that we should have a large vehicle, larger than normal spacecraft, and that it should fly and measure and observe for a relatively long time so that we can pin down the statistical numbers mm-hmm. which we are after. This is a particular problem in this kind of measurement. We want to measure a number which is very small, but we want to measure it with a good enough statistical significance so that we really can tell our designers how thick to build that wall, that protective wall for the spacecraft.
Yeah, may I interrupt here a moment?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, and again, this was an important design parameter because we were still talking about an Earth orbit rendezvous.
Very important parameter.
And that's where the whole problem was taking place. I mean, it was in that near-Earth environment that this particular...
This is right, but it is still about... Well, it's a little less... They are less frequent when you go further out,
mm-hmm.
because there's a kind of focusing effect near the Earth. But this effect is not too very strong. That means when you go out to the moon, it's still important to be protected against meteorites. And you cannot simply say, well, I get out of the Earth orbit quickly into the lunar trajectory, then I'm safe.
Mm-hmm.
See, there are meteorites. And when you look at a picture of the moon itself, you see what, how many times it has been hit
mm-hmm.
in the course of its history. Well, anyway, the problem is more severe near the Earth. This is correct, but it is not disappearing when we go away from Earth orbit.
Mm-hmm.
So the problems were, first, tanks near Earth. That means tanks near which are being used at the early time of a space flight.
Vehicle tanks, as well as spacecraft.
Vehicle tanks.
Vehicle tanks, okay.
Tanks near Earth. And then second, let me say boosters.
Booster.
And then tanks in space, of spacecraft. And then third, the housing capsules, the capsules of the astronauts. These were the three things to be considered, and all of them must be protected. This is for a shorter time, but they have a much larger area.
Mm-hmm.
And as a rule, they have thin walls. You know, the tanks of an Atlas or Titan or Saturn booster vehicle are very thin.
Mm-hmm.
This here is a problem for tanks in space. They are, as a rule, they are smaller, but they are still thin in order to be light. And then the capsules of the astronauts are still smaller, and they are normally heavier because they also must provide heat protection.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the three problem areas. And around that time, we set out to determine the design numbers for these three problem areas. And this was about the uncertainty. So we said at that time, we do need a sensor which is very large, and it should be flown in orbit over long enough time to provide us with statistically meaningful figures. And then after we had determined what kind of vehicle we need, we immediately saw that we could only use a Saturn vehicle to fly it, because all the others would be too small and the sensitive area would be too small to give us the figures.
Mm-hmm.
And then we found out that there would be in our Saturn I program, there would be at least one Saturn I that could possibly be made available for such a flight. And we proposed to our own management here then that we would like to build a meteorite sensing satellite for Saturn I launching, and that we would be able, hopefully, to pin down these design figures.
Mm-hmm.
The importance of this and significance was immediately recognized by our management, and we were in SSL, we were encouraged to proceed and to go ahead and make plans. And from then on, it became a project, a normal project, which has been described in technical reports. We began our design by looking in the payload capability and into the requirement for orbit altitude. See, when you want to have a certain lifetime of a spacecraft, you have to go up high enough so that the air drag does not bring it down too soon. And this satellite would have to be a very big one in order to provide enough sensitive area for the meteorite hits. So we had to go up relatively high in orbit. Then we determined how many pounds of payload a Saturn could carry into that orbit. And we arrived then at a particular size of sensors. This is the spacecraft itself, and this would be the sensors.
Mm-hmm.
We arrived at a size sensors which could be carried into a high enough orbit, and this was the basis then for the project.
Mm-hmm.
From then on, it's just a normal story of a development project. Now, we had not only one, but we had three flights. In the course of the development, it turned out that we could use two and even three Saturn ones, because the importance of this project was considered more important than any other payloads that could be flown with these Saturns.
Mm-hmm. But by the time that the Pegasus flights took place in 65, a lot of the design for the boosters and for the spacecraft had been finalized. Did you find that these designs didn't need to be changed on the basis of information gathered?
In essence, we found that the designs which we did use for the Saturn, they were verified, and our conscience was quieted, so to speak, and we found out that the design figures were good enough. Mm-hmm. In essence, there were no drastic changes, but we could. With the three flights, we could settle down this uncertainty here, or we could reduce the uncertainty and settle the question of how many meteorites there are within a very small error margin. You probably have these numbers, but it looks a little bit like this here, like this here. These curves are in the reports also, and we could really determine what the number of meteorites of a given mass are in space, and they came pretty much to the point which we had hoped for and expected, and which our designers had been using. Mm-hmm. It was a very good verification of our design numbers.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the secondary experiments then? I was wondering if you really got a lot of new and significant information on Earth albedo and the Van Allen belt?
Yeah, we did. We had some experiments on, as you may remember, on thermal radiation, mm-hmm. Earth albedo, and on paints, for example, protective paints and paints which would at the same time passively control the temperature of spacecraft with a number of experiments, and they worked excellently, mm-hmm. very well. We found out, actually we verified and helped to determine the white paint which was used on the Saturn vehicle from there on out. Mm-hmm.
Did you deliberately plot the orbit of the Pegasus through the South Atlantic anomaly, or did happen?
There is no other way. There's no other way of doing it. Uh-huh. You know, they plotted the South Atlantic anomaly better and more accurately than any other spacecraft had done before.
The Pegasus did.
The Pegasus, mm-hmm. Yeah, that was an additional bonus. But there's no way around it. Mm-hmm. Then going through, there would be a way around it if you put your satellite into equatorial orbit. The South anomaly covers about an area like this from about 10 degrees south. Now, any satellite which has an inclination more than about 10 degrees must go through, unless it is, well, this anomaly is coming down very low, as you know, it hangs down like a sack of coal from the sky, you know, really deep, and any satellite which goes down further than 10 degrees and up, you know how these orbits look like normally. Mm-hmm. Anyone that goes further will go through it every once in a while, and at least with every second or third flight, and mm-hmm. normally even, I think it's more often, I think, practically each orbit goes through the anomaly, at least to some of the fringes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you also found some things about the decay of starfish electrons, as I recall.
They were also recognized, yeah. Mm-hmm. They were recognized as being still there.
Yeah. Okay, then let's see, there were a couple of other specific questions.
In fact, the starfish electrons were recognized because of their time change, their change in time. You know that starfish population reduces and decays, and so we could measure some of this decay. Mm-hmm. And so we knew that these must be starfish and not natural ones.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is something that was just a... You had some radiation flux sensors on that, is that how
yes,
you...
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
And that's how the...
These were, electron counters.
Actually. All right, now there was some tumbling of the Pegasus.
Tumbling, yes, and we knew that this would happen. It even happened a little, if I remember correctly, a little more slowly than we thought it would. And the reason why this tumbling would happen is quite well known. It's an well-known law of mechanics that a body which rotates around some axis will gradually assume rotation around its axis of highest moment of inertia if there is a mechanism to take energy out of it. And this mechanism to absorb energy of its kinetic energy is, of course, the air drag and also magnetic damping, damping in the Earth field and the air drag. And these effects work together to finally make any motion of a body in space such that it rotates around its axis of largest moment of inertia. And in that case, it was a kind of a propeller type motion.
And now, I read some reports, I'm still a little confused on it. Was this welcomed? Because I read one thing that said that they actually accepted this movement because it gave them a wider count of possible meteoroid punctures as a function of the spacecraft movement. Yeah.
Position, yeah.
But there was a problem because the you bended some stuff, and maybe was there a problem because the couple of the early ones gave you a higher rotational thing than you really wanted?
This was on the first one. There was some venting of residual propellant.
Yeah.
The central portion contains some tankage, and there, of course, when you go into a desired orbit, then you do not burn all of your propellant. You just cut off when you have reached that orbit.
Yeah.
And so there was some propellant left, and that was vented, and it did not vent without exercising a torque on the spacecraft. And this torque by the venting, it acted actually like a little rocket engine, very small and low power rocket engine, and it changed the rotational mode of the system to some extent.
All right, on SA-10 too, the last of the Pegasus flights, there was an experiment that I thought was kind of intriguing, and that was the removable panels. You remember that?
Oh yeah, very well. And we had thought for some time that we could send an astronaut out with a pair of pliers to clip off the little clamps, you know, which we are designed and built for removal, and which we could bring back. Then, but the problem was that the subsequent flights did not go, the subsequent manned flights did not go to that altitude.
Mm-hmm.
See, we had to go to a certain altitude in order to obtain a long enough lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And that was higher than our manned flights went. And so we...
Where did the removable coupon idea come from? Is that such an unusual thing, or just it strikes me as kind of interesting?
No, well, it's an idea which came up at a number of places simultaneously. As soon as there was possibility of having astronauts doing EVA work, extravehicular activity work, you ask yourself, what can he do? And we said, he can bring back one of these panels, and we just look at it and see how the impact of the meteorites look like on it. And we liked the idea very much and pursued it for some time, but then we just found that there was no way of going up to that high altitude.
Can you say that Pegasus was the biggest scientific experiment that Marshall in particular launched?
By dimensions and volume, yes.
Was it the most important?
This is very hard to say, and I would not like to attach an importance figure to scientific experiments. You know, when you talk to an astronomer, then astronomy is by far the most important activity for scientists in space, and they have a very good point. I would probably agree to a large extent with the astronomers. Medical people will say the most important scientific purpose is to find out whether men can live under weightlessness, and again, that's extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be many things coming out of these biomedical investigations in the years to come, which prove to be extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, another extremely important thing to do in orbit is to look down on Earth and look at our own planet real well and find out how we can keep it clean and in good shape for the years to come.
Yeah.
Extremely important. Now, this year was very important because it